season. Marco Dano was once a top NHL prospect. He was drafted with the Columbus Blue Jackets organization in the first round and had that potential to be a true game changer. Top end talent, top forward, even though there were a few red flags. Welp, those red flags have brought his career down. 5'11", 212 pounds. That's not the greatest size and height for a hockey player. He claims he's in the best shape of his life. The Blue Jackets are now claiming that he's in good shape, and that is one of the reasons why the Blue Jackets have been compelled to sign him to a one-year deal worth $800,000. At the AHL level, that will be worth $300,000, I believe, so that is a guaranteed contract of a nice payday. But this is Marco Dano we're talking about. This isn't Sidney Crosby, Wayne Gretzky, Patrick Kane. Will Dano be able to make an impact? And here's why I think he will. Dano was once a top NHL prospect. It was a potential chance that this guy would be a top player. But he's fallen off. And here's a reason why. Constant trades. He came to the Blue Jackets as that guy. He can really do some things. And then he was immediately shipped off. Blindsided. He didn't like the trade. He wasn't happy. He wasn't comfortable. So he shipped to the Chicago Blackhawks from the Columbus Blue Jackets, along with center Artem Anisimov, in exchange for Brandon Saad. So that creates a dynamic. Now he's in Chicago. He's expected to perform. But then Andrew Ladd is traded to the Chicago Blackhawks. And guess who's shipped the other way to Winnipeg? Marco Dano, a first-round pick, and a third-round draft pick. Now we're in a precarious situation. Marco Dano's been on three teams in a short few years. His headspace is not good. He is struggling to fit in with the locker room. He's struggling between the AHL and NHL level. A string of trades can truly hurt a young player. That's not good. If you're traded twice, three teams, just imagine moving to three houses the first few years you're on the job. It can take a toll on you. It's always in your head, on and off the ice. But now Dano's back home, as he says. He's back in Columbus. And Columbus has the potential to open up a wave of opportunities for him. It's a low-risk move for Columbus because they are bringing back one of their once-top prospects that they traded away too soon and giving him a second chance. Artemi Panarin's gone. Sergei Bobrovsky's gone. Star power on this team is gone. And they are going to be letting the young guns rule this team. So without Panarin, there's a hole in the forward unit. Gustav Nyquist comes in, and you have to expect that he'll get a look to join Pierre-Luc Dubois and Cam Atkinson on the first line. That's not a space for Marco Dano, not yet at least. But here's where things get interesting. Nick Foligno, Boone Jenner on the left side, Josh Anderson, Oliver Borchgren on the right side. Those are some pretty good players, but that fourth line is wide open. Wide open. And then, the center depth is not good as well. Alexander Wenberg has been struggling. Can Wenberg open up his career? New opportunities. If not, Nick Foligno slides into the center spot. There's a winger spot open. The moral of the story is, the Columbus Blue Jackets went from one of the most consistent teams of the last decade, making the playoffs consistently with a strong team under John Tortorello, to a team of uncertainty. So why not add one more uncertainty into the mix in Marco Dano and see if he can replicate the success he once had early in his career and in juniors? Alexander Texier, Emil Bennstrom, Eric Robinson, Sonny Milano, they're all going to be fighting for that spot along with Marco Dano. But with a little bit of magic in his old home, maybe Dano can earn that role. From Marco Dano to the Stanley Cup, Jeremy Rutherford is on deck on Destination Hockey. I'm really excited to announce that the Blues reporter for The Athletic will be joining us, and we are going to reminisce on the glory days of Lord Stanley. From the destination for all things hockey, we will be right back.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that one in five people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
The St. Louis Blues just won the Stanley Cup this season, and we are joined by the man who was there the entire way. Jeremy Rutherford, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So this season, certainly a roller coaster to say the least, but with how much talent there was on the team, did you ever feel that they were out of it?
Yeah, I did. I have to admit, you know, I think the way they were playing as a team in early December, they got off to the tough start under Mike Yeo. They replaced him with Craig Berube on November 20th. And although it's only a couple months into the season at that point, still plenty of time to right the ship. They just weren't playing good hockey. And going into the season, there was a lot of people, including the coaching staff, saying that they would need time to gel. But to me, and I think others, as we watched the Blues team, it didn't look like a situation where suddenly it would just click once they got some time to play together. You know, it didn't look like a good system. They weren't getting good goaltending. Some of their top players weren't playing to the level that they were capable of. And then you look at the standings in late December, early January, and they're dead last in the National Hockey League. So to me, at that point, I had written them off. And fortunately, this is sports, and sports operate differently. And they don't adhere to kind of the norm in regular life. And the Blues were able to write an unbelievable story, win their first championship in their 52-year history, and prove a lot of people, including myself, wrong.
What changed in that locker room after January when the Blues were dead last in the NHL?
I think what happened is that, first of all, they did start to gain some chemistry. You can't overlook that, you know, with so many new faces, Ryan O'Reilly, David Perron, Tyler Bozak, Pat Maroon, that it was going to take some time. But I think more importantly, Craig Berube came in there and he held the team accountable. This is a group in that locker room. A lot of them have been together for a long time. It's the same leadership for the last number of years. And there were a lot of question marks with this leadership group and a lot of people who felt like Doug Armstrong, the general manager, should make some major moves and bring in some different players. But it's a situation where Craig Berube was able to go in there and get everyone's attention. And at first he did it by restoring the confidence in the team. He felt like they had lost that. So he restored the confidence, told them, hey, I believe in you guys. You are a playoff team. Matter of fact, he took the standings down off the wall that showed the Blues in last place, and he said, I don't care what these standings say, so we don't need to look at them. You guys are going to be a playoff team. And I think the team really fed off that. Talking to some of the players after Berube took over, they said that, you know, if not for him coming in and just really developing that message with them, that probably a good chance they don't make the playoffs.
Jordan Binghamton, another huge factor for that run. Monday, January 7th, Blues at Flyers. Binghamton shuts them out. 3-0 win. Ever since then, how confident was Binghamton? How amazing was his play en route to a Stanley Cup victory?
Yeah, the story of Jordan Binghamton is one that I've never witnessed before. I do remember he was a 2011 third-round draft pick. And early on in his career, you know, let's just say 19, 20, 21 years old, he'd be in training camp. And I remember thinking, well, I better talk to him and do an interview with him before they reassign him. And, you know, you got to be careful what you say to some of these young prospects because they all think they're going to make the NHL roster right out of the gate. And, you know, but I would be honest with Jordan and say, hey, you know, can I grab you for an interview this week? You know, I don't know where you'll be next week. And he would say, well, I'm going to be here. I'm going to make this team. And so he's had that confidence for a long time. But as he got up there in age, and, you know, that's relative because you're talking 23, 24, 25, some other goaltenders had climbed ahead of him on the depth chart, the most recent being Billy Husso, the Blues' fourth-round pick from 2014. So Jordan Binghamton just felt like the team was overlooking him, and he got a chip on his shoulder. They asked him to go to the ECHL, and he declined, and so they had to loan him out to the Providence Bruins, Boston's AHL affiliate, where he played a couple seasons ago. So Jordan Binghamton finally gets the call-up. He comes up to the Blues in December, and then finally on, you mentioned January 7th, he gets that first start, 25 saves, 3-0 shutout over Philadelphia. You know, and at the time, you're pretty impressed, but you're thinking, okay, rookie goaltender riding on adrenaline comes up and plays a really good game. And it was the Flyers, let's be honest. You know, the offense wasn't that great. But after that, he just showed the poise and demeanor of a guy who had been doing it for years and years. So Jordan Binghamton, you know, what does he go, 13-1-1 in his first 15 decisions, 5 shutouts in his first 18 starts, only the second goaltender in the modern era, 1943-44, only the second goaltender since then to have 5 shutouts in his first 18 decisions. Just remarkable. And the team was feeding off it. They finally had good goaltending, and they were starting to play a better overall team game. So you had no choice but to say that this guy is legit. You just didn't know, once you get deeper in the season, once you get into the playoffs, how is he going to handle it? That was the big question mark, and obviously we watched it unfold in front of our eyes. He handled it very well.
The playoffs come around, and unlike before the season, the Blues were not favored by many to do too well. How did the lower expectations help the team fly under the radar?
Well, they had been playing so well since January, second most points in the league behind Tampa Bay, that I don't think it was much of a surprise when you saw people call the Blues a dark horse in the playoffs. You know, they had the difficult draw in the first round. You know, in hindsight, you know, people look back, maybe Winnipeg was vulnerable. They hadn't been playing well the past couple months leading into the playoffs. But still, to me, they're a difficult team to play, a lot of size and skill. And to me, that MTS Bell Place is a very loud and difficult building. So to me, going into that series, you know, I felt like they had a decent chance with the way they were playing, but I would not have been surprised whatsoever had they lost. And frankly, the next couple series, same thing. You're talking about a good Dallas team with an outstanding goaltender in Ben Bishop. You're talking about a San Jose team that has a ton of experience. So to me, I looked at the postseason, and I felt like they were a dark horse-type team. But then once you get the play from Jordan Binghamton, and all of a sudden now your top players are starting to play like it, you thought to yourself, wow, there's really a chance here. This team really could make a Stanley Cup run.
An up-and-down first-round series with those Jets culminated during Game 6, where the Blues played I'm not even joking here, perhaps the greatest game of hockey I have ever seen from a team. How did that show this team that they could accomplish anything?
Yeah, it was just a dominating performance. I don't know that I've ever seen the Blues team 15 years covering the club play that well. What did the Jets have, one shot in the second period?
Yeah, I believe
like that.
So.
They were just suffocating the Blues defense. And, you know, to lose games 3 and 4, then I think they go back up to Winnipeg and win game 5. Now you come home with a chance to clinch. You know, the pressure, it's always tough to close out a series. And the Blues do that on home ice where they hadn't played very well. To me, I think that was the game that realistically told everyone that the Blues team had a chance. And I realize it's still early in the playoffs. It's still first round. You're talking about a team that had only made a trip to the Western Conference Final once in the last 16 years. That was a few years ago with the David Backes group. And a lot of turnover since then. So you're talking about a group that didn't have that much experience making a long run. But with the way they played in that game, you had to take them seriously.
In the next round, the Blues were matched up with the Dallas Stars, and the Stars upset the Predators in the first round thanks to stout defense and dominant play in net from Ben Bishop. Jordan Binghamton, the star who carried the team to that Stanley Cup, had his first real opposition in net staring him right down in the face. How did he prepare himself to go against one of the game's best from last season?
You know, I think with Jordan Binghamton, you know, it's easy to say this now because he has a Stanley Cup on his resume at 25, 26 years old. But I truly think, looking back at what happened, is that he didn't concern himself much with the opponent, with the opposing goalie, with the task at hand, with the building that he played in. I mean, I don't know how much you saw in terms of there was a storyline about Jordan Binnington's reaction to huge wins. There was a win against Tampa Bay earlier in the year, 1-0 in overtime. Braden Schenn scores, and Jordan Binnington just kind of taps the pipe and skates out, and, you know, that's it. Same thing in Winnipeg, same thing in the second round against Dallas. Win a game, and he just didn't show that much emotion. He had a job to do, and even though Ben Bishop was absolutely lights out at the other end, Jordan Binnington knew that he just had to do what he could do. And, you know, the stat that sticks out to me when you look at him, every time he lost a game in the postseason, he was a combined 8-2 in the very next game.
Wow.
He just showed a lot of composure, a lot of poise, and it really didn't matter who was on the other side.
Patrick Maroon, one of the Warriors that helped the Blues get to where they were, he was the hero in that series, scoring a game-winning goal in Game 7 in overtime. What was his importance to the team last year?
Yeah, it was an up-and-down year for Patrick Maroon. A big story here in St. Louis when he signed the one-year hometown discount contract with the St. Louis Blues. But it didn't get started off that well. I think he had, one goal in his first 16 games. And there was talk about trading him, but he had a no-trade clause that expired on February 1st, and then it was a modified no-trade clause. And so Patrick Maroon was a guy who quickly was finding himself out of the lineup and perhaps out of town. But he found a spot on a line with Tyler Bozak and Robert Thomas, and that line played really well. It was a possession line. They cycled the puck well. Patrick Maroon's size, his grit, you know, in the corner was part of that line, even though you could say that Bozak and Thomas with his puck skills, you know, played a bigger role. You got to give Pat Maroon credit for what they did in that line. So, you know, I don't think there was any one line or one player that dominated the postseason for the Blues. I think Pat Maroon, like others, had his moments. And you know, I think that they don't win the Stanley Cup without Pat Maroon. And you only have to look at his double OT goal against Ben Bishop, who we just referenced in that second round series, to say that. So Pat Maroon, I think, you know, what role did he play? It was a big one. And he's rightly so revered in this town as a hometown hero now after taking that hometown discount. And you know, the storyline here in St. Louis now is will they bring him back? And there just doesn't seem to be enough cap space. And nor do the Blues want to commit to a two-year term for Patrick Maroon. But I can tell you one thing. For the next 50 years, Pat Maroon's going to go around town, and he won't have to buy a single beer because people are going to do that for him.
So after that goal, the Blues are matching up against the Sharks. And the Blues, they didn't have to battle as hard this series, it felt like. But one thing they really had to battle against, obviously the Sharks were a physical team, even though the Blues made it look a little easier than the series prior, the refs are what really impacted the series. Some bad calls got in the way, including that hand pass on Timo Meier. How resilient was that team battling the Sharks and the referees?
Yeah, you know, you never like to make the referees an excuse, but it was an egregious call in Game 3 there. Sharks win in overtime on the hand pass goal. You know, I'll never forget that game, being the pool reporter, talking to the director of officials to get the ruling on that, and they realized that they messed up, that the officials messed up. And then shortly after that, we went into the Blues locker room. And, you know, I didn't expect the Blues to be, you know, holding court with reporters, making a ton of excuses, saying, you know, anything like, well, they got to battle the referees too. But at the same time, I didn't expect the Blues to be as relaxed as they were about the situation, saying, hey, it happened, you know, we're going to move on, we're going to come with a smile on our face tomorrow. It was pretty evident to some veteran reporters that have been around the team a lot that Craig Berube had already gotten to the team, which you'd assume, you know, right after a game, he's probably going to step into the room and say something. And that's exactly what happened. He told them. He said, hey, look, come to work tomorrow, ready to work. And so I was very impressed with the way Craig Berube handled it. I was impressed with the way the players listened. Sometimes your coach says something like that, and in one ear, out the other, you know, the frustration builds, and it's hard to get past something like that. But to their credit, the Blues did. I don't have the stat in front of me, but I want to say they outscored San Jose by a ratio of about 3-1 the rest of that series. I want to say that it was like 12-4, something like that, the last few games of the series. So the Blues really did come to work the next day and won that series, and you have to give a lot of credit to Craig Berube and his staff for being able to overcome that officiating error.
12-2 the rest of the way. The Blues absolutely dominating, and I was actually at Game 5 in San Jose. And that was an interesting game. Evander Kane almost scores 30 seconds in. It looks like it's going to be an even game, but the Blues just have this confidence to them, and they just pound the Sharks in and win that game 5-0. Binghamton gets the shutout, and the Blues go on to win Game 6. How important was that Game 5 dominance, similar to Game 6 from the first series, in helping them win the Western Conference Final?
Yeah, I think real important. You know, we touched on, you know, responding to the hand pass, and I just think after that they just weren't going to be denied. And obviously, I remember the Kane shot. You know, things are a lot different if that gets in and San Jose gets some early momentum in that game. But I just felt like this Blues team was doing what it had done since January, which was just showing a ton of resiliency. And you know, sometimes that word gets overused, and I was probably guilty of it in the postseason with the Blues. But I've just never seen a team absolutely positively never quit. And, you know, in part, that they had to take that approach because of the situation they were in. Last place in the league, January 3rd, you lose anymore, your season's over. So they just had that mentality that was ingrained in them throughout the last couple months of the regular season, and then just carried it into the playoffs. So, you know, even though Sharks come out with a little bit of momentum in that game, you know, they got past it, the Blues did, and win that game handily, and then go on and win the series. So, yeah, 12-2, that's the number that sticks out to me, is the way the Blues were able to dominate the Sharks after that situation.
And finally, the Stanley Cup, a historic series for a city that craved nothing more than the eternal glory that winning that cup provides. That they got thanks to a dominant team effort. It wasn't just Tarasenko, it wasn't just Binghamton, it was the whole team. How did unsung heroes like Robert Bertuzzo, Oscar Sundquist, etc., help that team win the Stanley Cup?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at the Blues and their run, and then, of course, sealing the deal with the Stanley Cup win. And you have your Conn Smythe winner in Ryan O'Reilly. You know, I voted for that award. I did pick Ryan O'Reilly as the winner. I had Jordan Binnington second, Tuukka Rask third. Colton Parayko was definitely on the radar. But my point being that, yeah, I just don't think the Blues win the Stanley Cup without every single player on that team. I mean, whether it be Robert Bortuzzo blocking shots, whether it be Zach Sanford chipping in a goal in the final game as kind of to put it away, whether it be Oscar Sundquist and him and his forechecking ability. It took Matt Grizzlick out of the series, you know, on that hit that earned him a one-game suspension. Ivan Barbashev had his moments. We saw earlier in the playoffs, Jaden Schwartz, who struggled all year long, just put the team on his back in the postseason with his goal scoring. And you can go up and down the lineup, and I think everybody played a role. Now, you could say that's the case every year with every Stanley Cup winner. You know, I get it. But I know that I've watched some Stanley Cup playoffs where it's, you know, two or three guys that are getting most of it done. And, you know, to me, this was the old cliche, that the team effort that got the Blues to the finish line.
And that team isn't just on the ice, it's off the ice too. And for you personally, you follow this team all season. You develop relationships with players, staff, and media members and their families in St. Louis. The Stanley Cup comes around, you're starting to get a taste of that victory. Do you start to have a teeny bit of an underlying rooting interest, hoping the Blues win, when you're reporting on the Stanley Cup?
Well, for me, it's a difficult situation because I grew up in St. Louis. I'm a lifelong St. Louisan. I've probably moved a couple times, but I've only lived within about a 20-mile radius my entire life. You know, some other beat writers, you know, I'm familiar with just about all of them throughout the league. You know, they grew up in Denver, and now they're covering, you know, let's just say the Rangers. They grew up in Boston, and now they're covering the Sharks. Well, you know, I've got a situation where I'm covering the team that I grew up watching. And yes, at one point, I was a fan. You know, you got the Blues posters, you go to the games, you wear the sweater, so on and so forth. And it's tough to lose that. But I would say, you know, and I've written this in the past, that, you know, once you cover the team, you have to cut the cord. You've got a job to do. You have to be objective. If you're not objective, you're not doing the job correctly. You owe it to the fans to call it as you see it, and hopefully I've been able to do that. But the one thing that the situation growing up being a fan of the team does for you is it allows you to understand what fans are going through, how they remember all the near misses, the bad trades, the games that didn't go their way, the injuries, so on and so forth. And it allows you to write it with a little bit more of authority because you can empathize with them. So as you're going through the playoffs and the Blues are winning and you see the town come alive, and, you know, we as reporters aren't immune to it. We have family members that are, you know, throwing watch parties at their house and so on and so forth. So I think more so than me rooting for the team and hoping they win, honest to goodness, that was never, like, part of me. But what was part of me was understanding how big it would be for the city of St. Louis, how many demons would go away, how the curse would be lifted in St. Louis if the Blues indeed won the Stanley Cup. And also, you know, I work with a lot of these people on a daily basis behind the scenes downtown at the St. Louis Blues organization. And you realize that these people work hard and they'd like to be rewarded, and, you know, that wouldn't be such a bad thing whatsoever. So I think that's how I look at that whole situation. You're never going to see me painting a blue note on my cheek, but if the Blues win the Stanley Cup as they did, it certainly was a great time and I was happy for the city.
That parade proved it. It was a historic day, one where a city could unwind after decades of hardship, after a curse that you just mentioned. How did that specific day, however, already exceed Hefty expectations?
Yeah, a couple ways. First of all, you know, like I said, lifelong St. Louis, and so all I heard growing up was when the Blues win the Stanley Cup, the parade on Market Street would be the biggest thing ever. And so you sit there and dream you know, as a fan growing up, will you ever see that day? And then you become a reporter covering the team. And, you know, just a couple of years ago, I wrote Bernie Federico's autobiography, and the last paragraph of his book is about how one day he's going to be on that parade float going down Market Street, and the sun's going to be beaming off the arch and beaming off the Stanley Cup, and he can't wait for that day. And so you just kind of envision it. Well, now here it is. It's, you know, a couple days after June 12th. People are arriving the night before. The people coming the next day are showing up at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning to get their spot. And by the time it started, about 11 or 11:30, you know, they were 20 deep on Market Street. And, you know, just a quick story is I wanted to do the best job I could covering this parade. And I talked to the Blues about potentially being embedded, one of the trucks, one of the floats. And they said, yeah, sure, just ask, you know, one of the players. So I talked to a couple players. Their trucks were pretty filled up. So Jake Allen was nice enough to say, yeah, jump on the back of my fire truck. So he had some room back there. So I did. And as we turn off of the street right in front of Enterprise Center and we make a couple rights, we turn onto Market Street. And if you didn't get goosebumps, you know, you're not human because, like I said, the roar... they're 20 deep. They're hanging from street posts. They're inside garages on the rooftop, and they were chanting. You know, I was like I said on Jake Allen's ride. I'm sure they were doing this with the rest of the players too. But they're chanting, "Jake the Snake, Jake the Snake." I mean, this guy, in terms of what he did in the playoffs, was probably last on the list. He only played the one game, and you know, was kind of a forgotten guy. And yet, here you have 500,000 people. You know, chanting the backup goalie's name. So it was a day I'll absolutely never forget, gorgeous day. And the way, to me, that it exceeded the expectations that anybody had was the fact that the players made it about the people, made it about the city of St. Louis. So many parades, pro sports franchises, they have the parades. They're about, you know, winning the championship, and you'll see them stand on their floats and hold the trophy, and you know it's over in a couple hours and that's it. And that's exactly opposite of what the Blues did. The Blues took the trophy to the people in the streets. They brought fans under the ropes and onto the streets and walked with them. I saw when Jake Allen ran out of beer, people were throwing beer cans for him to catch and chug the beer. To me, what they did and how they presented that parade to me was just amazing and made the day even more special.
Ryan O'Reilly was one of the players that specifically exemplified this Blues season, this parade, and all the glory that they achieved. In Buffalo, he lost his love of hockey, but in St. Louis, he instantly became one of the best players in the NHL. His day with the cup after the parade was extra special thanks to a parade in his own town and his grandmother's presence. What was that day like for the Conn Smythe winner?
It was great. And you know what? When the season was over, I talked to my editor at The Athletic, and I said, hey, let's go to one of these days with the cup. And talking about traveling, obviously you've got Pat Maroon here in town, and we did cover that one. But we were going to pony up and fly to one of the cities and spend a day with the guy having the cup. And I picked Ryan O'Reilly just because of what he meant to this team and the city and you know, everything that you mentioned. And so you fly 3 hours to Detroit, and you jump in a rental car, and you go 3 hours through some Canadian farmland till you arrive in Seaforth, Ontario. And I'm talking four or five streets, maybe, Main Street, you know, a handful of shops up and down the street, and that's basically Seaforth right there. You know, exactly what you think small-town Canada is, that's what I witnessed. And you wake up the next day, and Ryan O'Reilly and his family met at the fire department. They told me to meet there as well. And so I'm standing there inside the fire department. I've got my camera phone ready to go, and good thing I was ready because around the corner here comes Ryan O'Reilly, and he's got the cup over his head, and he's getting ready to put it in the lap of his 99-year-old grandma, who they call Granny O'Reilly. She'll be 100 in November, and you know, that's going to be one of the memories I hold of this season, is seeing her kiss the cup. And then they had a parade down the street, Main Street in Seaforth, and had a couple more parades throughout the day. And I'm glad we chose that one. I think it was the epitome of what you know, you think of in terms of a Stanley Cup day, and Ryan O'Reilly was as deserving as anybody on that Blues roster. So, you know, in conclusion, you mentioned him and kind of losing that passion for the game a little bit in Buffalo, and then he comes to St. Louis, and people in Buffalo were saying to themselves, you know, hey, good luck with that. You know, here's a guy who said that he doesn't even love the game. Well, he certainly got it back last year because he was their best player, their MVP, their all-star, their Conn Smythe winner, and they don't win the Stanley Cup without him, of course.
We have chronicled the past and now to the future. The Blues do not want this to be a one-and-done season. There are some uncertainties. Patrick Maroon, Ivan Barbashev, the future of Jake Allen. There are a few underlying things that you don't know about. You have some certainties. Jordan Binghamton back on a two-year deal. How can the Blues rebound off this historic high, manage expectations, and make another run at the Cup?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. You know, there are challenges for any team to repeat, to win the Stanley Cup back-to-back years. The Pittsburgh Penguins did it a couple years ago. You know, even if you've got a great team, and still a lot of things have to fall your way. I mean, there you know, you have to stay healthy. You have to get performances like the Blues did last year with Jordan Binnington. You know, is he the real deal? You know, you think he is, but we'll see once he gets going. The one thing with the Blues that you like is that 99% of the roster looks like it's going to be back. Pat Maroon probably being the lone exception. But the one thing with the St. Louis Blues team, and Doug Armstrong has admitted it, is that they're going to have to not necessarily recreate, because it's tough to recreate year to year, but they're going to have to find a way to play with pressure on them early on in the year, because the success that they had, like I said earlier, was based on the fact that they could not afford to lose anymore. They had to win from January 3rd on, or they would have not made the playoffs, much less played for the Stanley Cup and won it. So the Blues, you're talking about October 2nd, Washington Capitals, you know, are they going to feel that same pressure and apply it and play with that same passion that they did the last few months of last year? So remains to be seen. I know they're going to have a target on their back. That's obvious, happens every year with the defending Stanley Cup champs. So we'll see how they respond. But like I said, 99% of the roster coming back, there's going to be issues whatsoever, and they're going to be playing with a lot of adrenaline, first of all, and I think a lot of incentive, too, to show that last year, you know, wasn't a fluke, and they are indeed that team.
That was Jeremy Rutherford, Blues reporter for The Athletic St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yep, thank you.
When we return, the New York Rangers will be in the local spotlight. Top prospect and menacing physical defenseman Brandon Crawley will join me to discuss his career and the upcoming season. From the destination for all things hockey, we will be right back.
Oh, folks, you know what that music is. That's the time for modern design. This blue thing is a really new trend. A lot of the designers are trying to introduce blue as a new cabinet color.
This is topical for you guys. This is really topical.
And the mother said, well, I'd like her room to be gray. And the little girl said, Mom, gray is the color of depression.
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
Welcome back to Destination Hockey. Today I'm joined by New York Rangers prospect Brandon Crawley. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, dude.
Of course. So let's set the scene a little bit. Ryan Lindgren goes down. You are there to take on Liam O'Brien and make him pay for that hit, bringing him down in a dominant fight. How does that show your care for your teammates?
I think it was just kind of one of those things. Whenever you're playing against some of those guys that are out there just trying to hit some of the young guys, you take it personally when you know, a teammate like that gets cheap shotted. And I feel like it's my job sometimes to really stick up for my teammates. And when I saw that, I just really wanted to make sure that we kind of got even with it and set the tone. No one's really going to do that to my teammates, and I know my teammates would do the same thing for me. So,
over the last few years, the Rangers have brought in you, Cody McLeod, Boo Nieves, Brendan Smith, amongst other big physical players to add to that element of their game. How important do you feel it is to play that physical style of hockey in the National and American Hockey League level?
Yeah, I think, obviously, I think that physicality is something that I like to bring in day in and day out, and it's something I really build my game around. I think it's a staple in my game, so it's one of those things I like to really just do consistently, and I try to bring it day in and day out. So it's one of those things where it's kind of fading away in the game right now, and to have that element in your game is definitely helpful in terms of making the jump to the next level, and definitely something that's appreciated by your teammates as well.
You were so close to making that jump last year. You made it all the way to one of the last days of September before being sent to Hartford. How will that motivate you this season?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think it's very motivating. I mean, having a training camp last year and kind of going through all the motions, just really being more familiar, giving it being my second year last year, and just having a whole another year to grow up and develop, really come into my own, also having another full summer of working hard and putting on some muscle and strength and power. I'm really excited to go into camp, and I'm really excited to put my best foot forward and try to make the team this year.
You also dealt with some injuries last season, which are tough for any player. How are you able to overcome them and use them to grow?
I think injuries are always tough because, you know, you can't really be around your teammates, your team kind of just goes on even though you can't really contribute. So it's definitely tough mentally, but it's one of those things you got to take it and you got to grow from it. I think you learn a lot when you're sitting on the sidelines watching your team, and it's one of those things you just want to just really learn from and understand that things happen and you got to recover, and you just got to make sure that your body's in the best shape it can be and be ready when you're cleared and healthy and ready to go. So definitely a lot of learning goes into having those injuries, and taking everything you can in stride is very important when you get injured. So I definitely learned a lot from that experience.
Taking all of that into account, what are your goals going into training camp this season?
Yeah, I mean, this year, it's going into my last year of my contract, so I definitely, going to camp, I want to be in New York. Had 2 years now of development in the American Hockey League, and I think I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about being a pro. I've learned a lot about being an adult, and I think I just want to take all those experiences I've learned and really use them to propel me up to that next level and start to show the Rangers and show the league that I'm ready to make that next step to the best league in the world.
What have you been working on specifically this offseason to accomplish that goal?
So unfortunately, last year we didn't make the playoffs. So it kind of gave me some time to relax right after the season, but I decided I wanted to get right back into it. So I took like 2 or 3 weeks off, and then I started working out. So I actually will have 18 weeks of working out in the gym.
Wow.
So I've been putting on a lot of size and strength, and I've also been working on my skating a lot, you know, continue to work on my edge work and some other things like that. But really just wanted to get stronger and bigger and just really mature this year because I'm getting older. I'm 22 now, so I feel like I'm starting to put on some real big boy muscle, and I feel like I'm starting to come to my body, so I'm excited for that.
When you outline your off-season regimen and you're planning for all of these things, do you make a list of things you want to perfect in order, or do you just kind of work on getting that two-way best possible game ready for next season?
I think it's definitely a process. Right now, I've been working out in Stamford, Connecticut with Ben Prentice. He's like a world-renowned strength coach. So he kind of takes care of all the physical stuff in terms of the phases of going from strength to power to quickness, all that kind of stuff. So he handles that, which is really a blessing. And then in terms of skating, that's one of those things, as you get closer to the season, you start to ramp it up a little bit more. And I'm just really focused on my edges and working on my skating because, you know, the next level is all about skating and getting to those opportunities. So I really know that that's going to be something I'm going to need going forward for sure.
Last year, the Rangers struggled, but signs of a brighter future are ahead after a nearly perfectly executed rebuild. When you're playing in Hartford, how often do you watch the big league club?
I try to tune in whenever I can just to watch just the systems and watch some of the players. I have some good friends, obviously, who are on that team, so it was exciting to watch them and watch some of them do really well. I think it's really motivating to just see some of your peers, doing so well at that level. I think it gives you a little bit more confidence knowing that you can get your shot. It's right there, and you just got to really own it and embrace it. So it's definitely exciting watching those guys, but it makes you really want to work as hard as you can to get that opportunity for yourself.
How excited are you for the future of this organization, especially after adding Artemi Panarin?
I think, obviously the past 2 years in New York have been a little bit different. I know New York has been used to making the playoffs and being a really competitive team, but I think they've taken some really good steps now with the rebuild and acquiring some really good prospects. Obviously, we've signed some big-time forwards now, so I think everything's trending in the right direction, and it's super exciting to be a younger guy in the organization right now because there's a lot of opportunity there, and it just makes you want to work that much harder to get to the next level.
The Rangers have something no other team in the National Hockey League has, and that is Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena. What would it mean for you to play a season in that venue, especially being a local New Jersey kid?
I was fortunate enough. I played a preseason game there last year, and I had a lot of friends and family who were able to come out because I'm only actually 20 miles from the city. That's where I grew up, so... It's really special. I mean, to have the opportunity to play in front of your friends and family and in front of these people who really watch you grow up and watch you develop is, there's honestly nothing like it, and it makes this dream and this this goal of mine that much more special, and it makes you really want to fulfill it that much more.
Through 9 games last season in Hartford, you already had more points that year than the 64 games the year prior. How can you continue to tap into your offensive game as you try to make the next step?
I think, honestly, it was just one of those things where it comes with experience. I think my first year in the league, I was 20. I was coming right out of junior. So I was just playing against some younger guys, and I think there's definitely an adjustment when you make that jump from junior to pro. Guys are just bigger and stronger. So I think the more I saw the game, the more I started to understand the game, which was helping me kind of open things up and create more opportunities for myself, which ultimately led to me getting more points. So I'm really excited for this upcoming year. I think I've already had 2 years pro, so I kind of know the lay of the land, and I feel like it's only going to get a little bit more comfortable each year and each game. So I'm super excited going forward.
You ranked 4th in the OHL, 2nd amongst defensemen in plus-minus during the 2017 season. What does that say about your two-way game?
I think when I was playing in London, we were always blessed to have some unbelievable forwards up front, and it was always my role just to play a good defensive game. I think that was kind of something that really molded me into wanting to be a defense-first guy, so... I took plus-minus that really seriously when I was a junior, and I still do. I think being strong on the defensive side of the puck is really the staple in my game, and that's something I really take pride in. So I was definitely very happy that it worked out that year.
You were a huge piece in the Knights winning the OHL Championship and the Memorial Cup during the 2015-2016 season. How formative was that experience for you?
That experience was honestly it was amazing. I think that team we had that year was super special. Obviously, we had some unbelievable players like Matthew Tkachuk and Mitch Marner and Christian Dvorak, and there's a lot more to go on with that list. But really, the thing that stuck out to me with that year was we were all so close as a group, and we kind of learned just how important it is to really come together. We came together at the right time. We all really enjoyed being together. So I think I understood the importance of the locker room and the chemistry that goes into winning a championship and how important it is to fulfill that.
You've done that at multiple levels. You also won the 18U championship with the Select Hockey Academy in the USPHL. How did you draw upon that experience in the OHL? And what does it say that you've won at almost every level you've played at?
Yeah, I mean, going to Selective Academy was also a good experience for me. We had a good team there as well, with the Nationals. But just kind of a smaller scale. So I think as you move up, you know, the scale gets a little bit bigger and the stage gets bigger. So just being able to reflect on those experiences of winning and what it's going to take in the moment to win is super important and bringing that to the next level. So fortunately, I was able to bring that to the OHL, and something I'm looking forward to, hopefully bringing this to pro as well.
One thing I noticed about your game when scouting you for this interview was that during the playoffs, you take significantly less penalty minutes as the games get more important. How are you able to change your style when the postseason comes around?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the playoffs, the refs tend to kind of loosen up on some of the smaller calls. So I think it gives you a little bit more wiggle room to play that physical style and be hard to play against. So I think that kind of plays to my advantage, but you know, it's really important in those playoff games that you rein it in, because these teams now they have so many dynamic forwards on the man advantage, so you really don't want to be the person to put your team in that situation. You want to make sure you're giving your team the best chance to win, so it's important to stay out of the box in crucial moments of a season like that.
You have played with high-end talent, as you mentioned, such as Matthew Tkachuk, Mitch Marner, and Christian Dvorak. Now you're looking to play on the Rangers with Artemi Panarin, Chris Kreider, Brady Shea, amongst others. How will that help you play defense behind such an elusive forward group, and why has that been helpful for you as you rise to the NHL?
Yeah, I mean, it was honestly a great experience getting to play with some of these high-end guys in London. You know, there's some other guys I played with as well the years before, like Max Domi, Michael McCarron. Like, so these guys, just you learn a lot from being around them, just their daily routines, the way they approach the game, and I think you can learn so much from just being around them and just soaking in the way they go about things, because guys like Matthew Tkachuk, you know, who have a full family of pedigree of playing at that next level, it's just important that you kind of watch what they're doing and you start to replicate it and bring things that they're implementing in their game to your game. So it's definitely been a great experience, and I'm excited to continue to learn with some other unbelievable players.
Here on Destination Hockey, we focus on the local New Jersey community, one that you are a part of being from Glen Rock, New Jersey. What does being from this state mean to you?
Yeah, I think it means a lot. I think New Jersey is not really looked at as a hockey hotbed in any way, and I think, you know, it's really starting to change. I think we got a lot of good players coming up. There's already tons of players who've made their mark in the league. And then there are other players who are just starting to make their mark in the league. Like, you know, a good friend of mine, Connor Clifton, the Bruins this year, he had a great playoff run. So it's really exciting to see guys like that. And, you know, all the New Jersey guys root for each other, and we all want the best for each other. So it's really exciting to see guys like that have success. And it's very inspiring and motivating to want to get there with them.
How were the hockey programs at Bergen Catholic and other ones near Glen Rock that helped you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple youth organizations, and I've had tons of coaches. So for me, it was just really taking little things from each coach was really important for me. So every coach kind of has brought a different element to my game, and being able to have so many coaches and guys to learn from has been, you know, definitely a huge blessing, and I'm very fortunate and thankful to have that opportunity.
So what advice do you have for other New Jersey hockey players chasing that NHL dream?
My advice would just be that it's never really a linear path. You're going to go through ups and downs, and there's going to be hurdles. But it's important to just stay the course and take everything day by day. I think if you focus every day on improving and getting better and just honestly loving the game, you know, eventually you stack those days on top of each other. When you look back 2, 3, 4, 10 years, you realize, you know, you're starting to really go somewhere, and that's motivating, that's inspiring. So really just take every day in stride and focus on getting better, and the rest will follow.
Being from New Jersey, you understand some of the local rivalries that you are hopefully about to encounter. How excited are you to hopefully be a part of Rangers Flyers, Rangers Islanders, and of course, Rangers against your local New Jersey Devils?
Yeah, I mean, it was really cool. My first preseason game, actually, I got to play at the Prudential Center against the Devils, which was really special for me. Just I grew up very close to the Prudential Center, and I did a lot of doubles games growing up. So to be on the other side of the glass and be a part of that rivalry and kind of just see what it is firsthand to play in it is it's super special, and it's honestly something it's hard to put in words because it's just it's something that you've just really watched, and it's inspired you really to play hockey. Watching those Devils Ranger games, those Devils Flyers games, those Devils Islanders games, like all those games have just really inspired me. So to be on the other end and be able to play for you know a team like the Rangers is it's unbelievable.
Finally, before we let you go, I want to talk about something near and dear to my heart and near and dear to your heart as well. You have two dogs at home. What have they meant to you growing up?
So I have two dogs right now. I have one girl, Welsh Corgi, and a Yorkie and a Bichon mix. That's a boy. His name's Fritz. And it's just nice, you know, like come home and see those dogs. Get all excited. It's kind of distract you for a little bit, and just takes your mind off of everything that's going on. So it's definitely nice to have those little guys running around and to distract you for a bit. So I love having my dogs around. That's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a great opportunity to speak with you. Good luck next season, and I wish you the best.
Thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Brandon Crawley, a player that I could not imagine I would have gotten to know as my time on Destination Hockey, but the connection was locally made, and Brandon Crawley, I'm telling you right now, has the potential to be a major contributor for the New York Rangers next season. Good player, good person, hard worker, and he will be fighting for a spot out of training camp. That concludes one of my personal favorite episodes of Destination Hockey. You can catch us on Instagram at @drive4five, Twitter @drive4five_, and on Facebook at the official Destination Hockey page. Also, do you need tickets to a game, concert, or Broadway show, especially with the Mets and Yankees going on red hot streaks? Well, I have the solution for you. Use code DRIVE45 on SeatGeek, a website for all your ticket needs, and get $20 off your first purchase of $29 or more. That's all I've got for you today. For more great content, including that Noah Dobson interview I've been promising all summer, we will have you covered for the next few weeks. But until next time, from the destination for all things hockey, see you next week.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise financial advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heidi and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
The pillow, the travel pillow, the Giza Dreams bed sheet, lots of savings there. MyPillow.com, use promo code USA and save on everything on the website.
Rising tensions over trade have dimmed Americans' opinions of China. Here's more from USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes.
A new Pew Research Center poll finding that 60% of Americans surveyed say they have an unfavorable view of China overall. That 60% is up from 47% last year and to the highest proportion since Pew started asking the question in its surveys 14 years ago. This survey finds 24% of Americans regard China as America's top threat for the future. That's the same percentage that said that of Russia. North Korea, the only other country to draw double-digit concern at 12%. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
Heat alerts have been issued for at least 15 states and stretch from California to Kentucky. Temperatures in Phoenix could reach 116. Dallas could see 109. The heat is expected to last through Friday. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
With a recession ending, if you've been putting off building your business, now is the time to act. General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now before steel prices go up.